You're listening to Post Perspectives Meet the Artist podcast, sponsored by Puget Systems.
Hi, I'm Randy Altman with Post Perspective, and welcome to the latest episode of our Meet the Artist podcast. For this edition, I spoke to veteran colorist Maxine Gervais about her start in the industry, which involves Peter Doyle, and much more. Enjoy. Hi, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you have a busy schedule and really appreciate the time to chat.
My pleasure. It's been a while since I saw you last time.
It has. We might have been next to a canal in Amsterdam, I believe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, definitely physically, the last time I saw you, that's probably it. Yes.
Yeah, I know. And I've spoken to you throughout the years about the different projects that you've worked on. So you have this rich history. And why don't we just dig in there? Why don't we talk about essentially how you began, how your path led to where you are now? I know that you went to school for
fine arts.
Yeah, fine arts. So how did that develop into where you ended up?
Well, it's, you know, it's funny. First, originally, I thought I was going to do teaching, you know, so I went in fine arts, but like, you could either just want to be an artist or study arts to teach it. And as I was like in the first trimester, I realized like, oh, I don't think I'd be a teacher. I really just want to pursue art. And it was nice because you could touch all the medium. You could do photography, learn how to develop your own photos. You could do sculpture. Like, you know, the first year, you kind of really just go and try everything from painting, photography, sculpture. And interestingly for me, like, although I really like painting and photography, I took a liking for sculpture because it was like, you know, there's the physical aspect of it, like, you know, the involvement. Like, I just loved how it would manifest. And then when I was done, like, at the end, like, you know, like, you have to pick your special, like, you know, what you want to focus on, which is what I picked. As I was, you know, talking with my family members and all that, somebody was like, well, you know, you always like also like math and you like science, you know, you're artistic, but you also have like this other side, like maybe you should go to robotics. So as I'm like searching for this, I stumbled upon like software for movie and television, right? And it was like 3D software, like the Maya, 3D Max, you know, like the composite software and all that. So you would learn all the software. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of like, it's not robotic, but I could do, you know, I could like kind of create artistically through these programs. So I really kind of like digging into that. And I did an underwater scene and I rendered it and all that. And then that was kind of my graduating project. And I sent it to different places. I sent it to Disney. But I get out of the blue, like I get reached by Disney, and my English wasn't really strong. And this person's reaching out saying, hey, we're really interested. Could you give us a breakdown of your demo? Like the, you know, the underwater demo you sent us. And I was like, a breakdown? What's a breakdown? Like, I ended up getting the information from my teacher, and he was like, you just have to tell them exactly step by step how you did it, how you applied the texture, how you did this. So, you know, with my poor English, I go, and anyway, long story short, make it to interview one or two. I think I made it to the third, but then it was a matter of like, if I had a path to a visa. That's my long story with the US. And I didn't, and since it would be a junior position, I didn't get it. But it felt really already like, oh, the LA, California, the Hollywood calling, there's something there, right? I'm early on. So all sad and, you know, like feeling like I'm touching something so big. But then I kept pursuing after graduating, and I heard of, because some of the software I had learned were from Discrete. So I applied for Discrete at the time that were doing Flint Flame, Inferno, you know, like, they had, I think they were with Maya, but they also, because they got purchased by Autodesk, then got 3D Studio Max at the time. And, you know, like they had Combustion, and eventually they acquired Luster from the Hungarian, from that has Jasbirini brothers.
The two brothers that then created Colorfront, right?
Yes.
That's
prior to Colorfront. Yeah, exactly. Prior to Colorfront, they had created a software that was called SAC that was used to do the color on the Lord of the Rings. And then Discreet bought that software, renamed it, and became Luster. And at the very beginning, I think Luster was kind of like considered like the color software that was solely built for DI as we know, right? Because like you could argue that for DaVinci and all that, it was an afterthought, as this software had been completely built and created for coloring movies digitally. So Discreet acquired that, and the timing is great because they originally, for me, more technically, because I had the artistic background, and once I got really technical, they then put me on the Luster team to become part of that specialty, like part of that special, being one of the specialists of Luster for Discreet.
The technical, so it's interesting. So you started with sculpture and like texture, like the feel of it, and then you moved to the computer and you sort of combine these two worlds, like you said, of the technical and the creative. And then did you have a hand in sort of developing Luster further for people that would be using it? I mean, was that part of what you were doing?
Yeah, it was mostly like, basically we would, you know, it was like so early and nobody knew how to do this yet. So there was no like real roadmap for that. I just knew how the software is supposed to work, how you're supposed to do it and all that. And so as we're logging, you know, obviously like there's bug reports and people are expecting it to work this way or this way. And so like I was kind of heavily involved in all that. There's the early days of like how to handle, you know, like files and sand storage. And it was, everything was so new because you were scanning and it's like making proxy out of 2K, because at the very beginning, you know, 2K was the big file. So I was involved in all aspect and all that. But what happened is that it was not a lot of colorists doing that yet. It was very early ages, because when I was put on Luster, it must have been 2002. You know, so okay. Really early stages of DI as we know it. And there was Jan Yarbrough that was in, like everyone, you know, fast forwarding, basically like, you know, Peter Doyle had sort of four wall his Catwoman at the Warner Studio in Burbank. And under Jan Yarbrough, at the time, was overseeing that facility. And they were not really Luster base at the time, but Peter was. And so Peter didn't have a lot of support. And Peter knew Luster very well because, like I said, prior to being Luster, it had been SAC, which he had used for the Lord of the Rings, at least the early one, right? I believe Dave Cole was also involved in the Lord of the Rings at the time, too, you know. So anyway, he's needing support. He's needing people that know Luster to come help him on Catwoman. So as my name has traveled, because I had become very savvy in the Luster world, but also everyone was like, but she's also artistic. She does freelance on the side. You know, she's... You know, she can do VFX, she can do this, she has like the art background. So Peter was like, you know, so maybe she would be a good fit. So I get contacted through Discreet by Jan Yarbrough to go meet them at the Burbank lot. And I do the whole thing, the tour and all that. And there we go again with a pat for a visa, which there is no pat for a visa. So again, I'm touching it. I'm like, my destiny. There is something there, you know, from Disney to now Warner Brothers. But it stayed in Peter's mind. Again, we're talking early ages, I guess. he had heard so many great things and all that of like my artistic and VFX capacity plus what I was doing for Discreet. And eventually he got awarded two movies, which was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Harry Potter, the Goblet of Fire. They had the same schedule, literally on top of each other. So he was at Pinewood and I was at Leavesden, and it would be a schedule that would not fit. So it was like, he had the role of supervisor, but obviously with very limitation of being involved. So when he asked me to do it, I was still at Discreet. So I had to quit if I was going to do it, which I decided to do. So I quit Discreet. I packed all my stuff. I went, I visited some labs, I believe, before I left. And then I went to Hungary to deep dive with the brothers at a company over there, you know, and they had a girl that was really also artistic, and had done DI in Hungary with the software. So I went there to get more of an in-depth training, and I did the color labs to understand more of the printer points and how, because I knew how to develop pictures and all that, but there's a discrepancy. I mean, it's not the same thing to like have a develop a photo than do an entire movie, you know, calling lights throughout and this and that. So I just wanted to really understand the language of the DP, because although it was digital at the time, the language was not, nobody talked into, video terms. Everyone was like, can give me a stop or half a stop or print, you know, in printer light still. So, and Luster was very good at translating, all of their tools into doing a printer light. You knew exactly what to do to get these same kind of callings you would have in a lab. So I made sure I was very versed into that. Then it was my job to meet with Mike Newell and Roger Pratt, and they had to bless me. And if they blessed me and felt comfortable, and also the Mitchell, the VFX supervisor, so everybody had to kind of bless me. And once they would do that, then it was my job to, excuse my French, but not mess it up, you know, do a good job. So Peter would be like from the distance, making sure everyone was happy while he did Charlie. But that was my very first break, my big movie. So, and it was a big risk, you know, you quit a good job. I mean, it was a good job that allowed me to travel, and basically because of traveling and helping people understand how to do this, it got me that opportunity. And because, you know, of Peter thinking, you know, this girl seems to have it all, basically, at the time. I don't know if he regrets it today, you know?
I can't imagine. But the thing is, like, that's a big fit. That for your first feature film, that's a pretty big one to start on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, it's almost as if, like, you go straight into your Waterloo in the sense of, not only was it big and difficult and, you know, at the time, it's like you do everything digital, but everything is going back to print. You know, there's no major digital release at the time. Like, it was still like a major film release because, what, was there 5 digital projector around the world? Like, I mean, it was still like nobody had converted to digital. So, there was a lot of like still like figuring out how to, you know, and it's not like if I had a team either. Now I have like a color scientist and this and that. I have like this major support. Like, you're talking at the time, it's like, you know, like I still kind of like technically have to also figure things out. And the machine itself, if it crashed, with like kind of an engineer that we're trying to patch it up together. Like, it's like, it was very, it feels almost, for such a big thing, it feels almost so bare and ghetto compared to like the kind of support I have today, you know?
Sure.
But it was, I was on it for a longer time than today. You know, you had a lot of like, basically, they would view the film dailies, scan it, then I would get all the dailies scanned. So I was there throughout the dailies process, all the way to the DI. Like, it's like a 2-year involvement on a movie. So you learn everything through that, you know? You learn very early how to handle from the dailies all the way to the VFX. So it gave me tremendous amount of knowledge in a very early part of my career.
And how does that translate to the work that you do now? And also, that's very different from the colorists that are coming up in this generation, because you were, I mean, you had this photography background, you were working with film too. So how does that sort of help you in your job today, that knowledge, that background? And how do you think the young people that are starting out could sort of get a feel for that as well?
That's a really complex, in-depth question. I find it very difficult because there's so many, like, I could have five different answers on this. And also there's like different, I can take it from this angle or this perspective or another perspective and from different philosophy, right? I could be more of a traditionalist and be like, well, if you don't really have the knowledge of the film and where this all comes from, and you treat color as an Instagram filter, eventually, you know, the quality will degrade, right? Like eventually, you know, you will just get things that will break and that will not hold through time, that will, that will create problem in the longer run, because you could argue that, you know, everything that has been done a long time ago can be restored, can be can be enhanced, can be this and that. But eventually, if you lose the knowledge along the way and treat things just like everything that is under the hood gets lost, and then eventually it's going to degrade in the quality. But at the same time, the technology goes so fast now that you could argue the other way as well. You could say, well, the technology is catching up and you can treat it like that. And it's going to know how not to break and everything is going to be AI generated. So there's different philosophy, obviously, depending of who you work with. You know, it's so funny because when I started, you know, people still start talking stop, you know, and like, can you give me half a stop or whatever? And that died out pretty quick. I felt everything died out pretty quick, you know. There's like this nostalgia of film and people wanting to go back to shooting film. And to me, I feel like 5 minutes ago, yeah, I still had film emulation as a starting point. And those film emulation were very constraining, because a chemical bath could not output the kind of color that we get like from pure digital color, right? So you needed to have this film emulation. You were always tracking with the bath at the lab, you know, and getting the numbers and doing those film emulation for you to view your material through, so that when you would originally, right, when you would film out, you know, you knew that what you were looking digitally would match the print you would get. So you had to constantly emulate that print through your lookup table. So I still have some of those lookup table. So when it, like someone's like, oh, I want like I want a nice, good, like old, you know, 5219, you know, like sort of like they call for like a film emulation, they call for a stock, or they call for like a bleach bypass or ENR type of, and you give them a legit one that I might have used like, you know, 12 years ago. And it's as if they forgot the aesthetic. I mean, some of them are like, oh yes, but very rarely. Most of them is like, oh my God, that's way too aggressive. It's way too harsh. So, you know, it's very funny how the language of lab and like film language kind of drifted away. It's very funny how like even the aesthetic has drifted away like super quickly, although the nostalgia has remained, you know? And, you know, like it's kind of like sometimes I feel like a little bit backwards in the sense of like, I remember how much people were putting pressure for Kodak to get a cleaner, like, you know, cleaner stock. Like, you know, they didn't want a grain, and look at that, there's almost no grain. And everyone was like so excited to have this beautiful film with like fine grain that you could barely see. And now it's like everyone wants to add grain on everything, you know? So, you know, now it's like, they're like, how can I, if I cannot shoot film and if I cannot, you know, do a process where I'm adding real grain to my image, like what's the best thing to give me that grain? So it's, I don't know, I'm not really answering your question, but I'm just saying all of this knowledge help you understand like what's real grain versus not. You know, like if I'm just there like doing an Instagram filter and I'm doing like a grain filter and all that, that's not grain, it's noise. It doesn't interact with the material as grain would. And if you really want to have that grain layer and not like a filter that floats over things, then you have to have that knowledge, understand, you know, where it come from, how it, you know, how it was interacting, like from the, you know, to the low, the mids, this, that, like the, you know, all of that knowledge is very important for me to understand how to treat the image. But I understand that you can still probably get beautiful result without that knowledge.
You're listening to Post Perspectives Meet the Artist podcast, sponsored by Puget Systems.
Well, so the language, you bring up the language, and that's important because you tend to work with, you know, frequent collaborators, Clint Eastwood being one. But so why is it so important? And oftentimes a colorist will leave a studio and their clients will go with them. It's a very relationship built, you know, it's built on strong relationships and that communication. So how do you make sure that you're speaking the same language as the director, as the DP? What's important? Is it lookbooks? Is it, you know, physical examples of what they want? Or is it just based, like with Clint Eastwood, you guys work together so often. So how do you make sure that the language is on the same page?
Yeah, I mean, there's like a very, I think, you know, I mean, there's different, for me, like, it's like, I think it's like a more intuitively, you know, it's like, for like someone like Clint, it's, he doesn't have to say many words. Like, it's just like the way he will describe what he wants and what he commands to the DP, basically, like into the imagery and all that. I already know where he wants to go. So usually I have a pretty good feel of where him and the image wants to go just from a few words or description. And like recurring clients, that's pretty much it. It's like, you know, they can give me some, you know, like, but sometimes they'll give you like images, right? A lookbook, and it's very eclectic. It's like, it goes from like, you know, something that's like Amelie to a horror, and you're like, okay, like it's, but it's just, if you really understand them and their sensitivity, you kind of, it's very intuitive. It's an intuitive process. And as far as the language, it's a, you know, it's, you know, like, it's funny because I don't know, I end up with clients that are speaking more filmly, like they're speaking more in density and contrast and these terms that are closer for me to like the film days than talking in, when you're talking to, I wouldn't even know how to tell you, like people that are talking to like gain gamma, you know, the gain gamma language, you know, has been more into the video world, as film was always like contrast and density and, you know, with the stops and this and that. So I don't know if it's because I start talking like that and they just follow around, you know, like they just go with it and they're like, oh, okay. But you know, I've learned like a few clients that I've had that were talking in live, gain, gamma. I had to translate it in my own head, same way as my French to English, right, so that I could put it in terms of contrast, highlights, density, and all that. Because, you know, it's still in my head how I work with, like, you know, it's still for me density and the contrast, the shadow and highlights. You know, this is how I operate in my head. So even if someone would have to use the, like, a more video language, a video-driven language, I translate it into these film terms in my head. But everything else, though, like, you know, when they're like, everything that gets described and all that for me is, you know, you have to be able to read the room, you have to, that's a job of a colorist or a good colorist is very much, there's, you know, like a translation of what people are saying and being able to apply that into color. And there's an intuitive and sensitive side that has to be there in order to be able to do that, right? Because otherwise, I mean, there's different kind of colorists. You could also be like, well, I don't care what you say. This is what works for this, and this is how it should be. And, you know, and I'm, you know, you hire me for doing the colors, so, you know, like, listen to me, right? Or, you know, like, if it's very collaborative, you really try to, like, give them what they want. You can advise, well, you know, maybe, like, steer them in a different direction when you try to go there and you see, like, like, let me show you something else. And it becomes very collaborative and very organic. And, you know, and again, like, intuitively, you can feel and sense how they also respond to what you show them.
Now, what about providing LUTs? Like, so are you getting involved in projects even earlier to the point where, like, even before the shoot, so you're creating LUTs for these guys to follow on set, and then that translates back to you? And do you like working that way? What are the benefits for you as a colorist?
Oh yeah, that's definitely the best. The best is when you can get involved, you know, early on and be involved in like how the dailies are gonna, you know, be done. And usually I create LUTs, one or multiple depending on, you know, the show or what they want. And, you know, I like to even like be put on pics or whatever software they have, so I can take a peek at the dailies throughout and make sure that it tracks and everything's good. I'm also always available if, you know, like some people have like, I have LUTs that are like more open and safeguarding where you could go in any like really dark or really bright and you'd be safe with that. But it's a non, it doesn't have a lot of heavy look built in, right? And I always feel like the more heavy look is built into your LUT, it might be great when we do testing at the beginning, but you'll never know how it will hold out until, you know, you go and you have to shoot in a cave with no lights, you know, like then you might need like a different LUT. You might be like, oh, okay, our heavy look there is a little challenging and I'd like to have something more open or whatever, or the same LUT, but like adjust the curve a bit. So I'm always available to tweak that as we go. So I think that rapport is important. It builds trust. And also, I know what I'm going to get and I can help maintain the quality of the image throughout their shoot. And also it's good for, because, you know, like a lot of times DPs don't want to be burned in a way that studios get used or, you know, not because of bad things, you know, it's just like they're viewing dailies and they're used to a certain look. If it's super bright, you know, but that's not all the intention of the creative. And all of a sudden, you know, like you want to go really much darker in the DI, then there can be friction, right? Because people got used to seeing everything, you know, it's like, what do you mean? Like, we're going to have like, so I think like the closer you can get like a lookup table, it's not the final look, but it's making, you know, like the studio get used to an image when they're viewing through pics or the dailies, you know, and it's close enough, the DP as a starting point that, you know, they have wiggle room to go under or over without, you know, scaring people, is, you know, golden and really helpful for everybody.
Now, you've worked on dramatic films in terms of relationships but you've worked on also superhero films. I mean, do you have a preference? Do you like mixing it up like that? I mean, and what do you like about both?
You know, I wish I worked like on every movie prior to 2012. I really like, you know, like I feel like there was an era of movies that, I don't know, you'd go to the theater and come out and be like, whoa, you know, like, you know, I remember going to see Dust Till Dawn and being, what happened there? Or like, you know, like there was so much, or Memento, or everything was always a little, I don't know, out there and with like strong storytelling and death and character that you were just so interested into. And I feel like through the years, you know, like there's a like there's been like introduction of fast food in the film, you know, in the filmmaking. I'm not saying that in a negative way, you know, fast food is great, but if you get oversaturated with fast food, it's like it affects everything else as well, because it's like, you know, then everybody's trying to do just a more fancy burger. You know, you know, it's like McDonald's takes over everywhere. And it was like, well, how are we going to compete with that? Well, we'll just do gastropub. But then you don't have like all the nice fine cuisine dies out a little bit. You know, I'm not saying there's no fine cuisine in the movie making, but I like superhero movies, but I still even saw from the first Iron Man to where we got sometimes, I saw a lot of, even in the storytelling, like for me, like you can see the difference even there. So I'm hoping there's a return. I love at the Oscar, I think it was a DP that talked, or director, I can't remember. Somebody said, you know, that it's risky to make a $200 million movie. So why don't you make $10 million movie?
But it's true. But then you look at like Black Panther, which is a superhero movie, but it's also got these strong characters and this wonderful story as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, you get to play in both worlds, which is really very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, Black Panther, I liked it in the sense of like that was like a kind of new in its genre into the superhero world, right? It's like it brought something that had never been brought to people, you know, out there. And I think you know, Ryan is really great at storytelling. I think the first one was so powerful for so many people. So yeah, that was like if I have to be on a superhero, that was a great one. And there's other superhero movie out there that I really think are great. I didn't color. There's a lot of like cool stuff in the hero as well. And yes, I'm really into it. And I'm just saying that, hopefully people would not sit on their laurels and push the envelope into, you know, if you are doing like, yeah, like something like, you know, like the Black Panther of this world, like, yeah, keep doing the character development and the deep story. It's not because it's a superhero that it has to just be like, you know, it can like carry depth and it can carry story and it can, you know, really push the envelope. So, but it's refreshing to, you know, go between, the drama, the suspense, the horror, it's good. Even a documentary, you know, like it's good to be able to go between different things and then series, and it keeps you on your toe, it keeps you engaged, and then you can explore also color wise and like technology and color, and you know, it allows you to always upscale your skills and everything.
Some of the films that you're working on now and TV shows as well, do you want to name a few for us?
Yeah, I am working with Robert Zemeckis on their new movie called Here. It's based on a graphic novel called Here. So I'm super excited about it. I think it's like, it's going to be one of his, like, I think we're like in the Forrest Gump era. Like, you're like, it's really good. It's very, very different, and it's very close to that graphic novel. So it's like if people, you know, are interested, you can like, you know, go and order that graphic novel and you'll have a sense of what the story is. But so I'm working on that right now. And then I have like my longtime collaborator, C. Kim Miles, that we're working on like a Christmas movie, so it's going to be for next year, but we're going to start in a few months as well. And then I have I'm doing the next season of Nine Perfect Stranger. That's a few things.
So, and then just going back to your beginnings with fine art, where do you find inspiration? Do you find it in fine art? Is it other films that you've seen and respect? Is it just the sun, the moon? Like, where are you finding your inspiration?
Well, it's a little bit of everything you just said, to be honest with you. You know, like sometimes I'll drive and I'll take off my sunglasses because there's a certain, like, let's say I had a discussion with DP about like a scene, right? And we're discussing, is it orange? Is it pink? hold on, like what color are we going for? Because, you know, for making people feel that it's the morning, or making people feel like it's like, you know, sunset or whatever. And then I'll be driving and I'll think of this scene and I'll make sure, okay, hold on, filter, no filter. Because, you know, sunglasses, it's like, hold on, how did they look at that sunset? Was it with the sunglasses or without? And what's the purity of the color when I don't have the sunglasses? So all this goes through my head as I'm driving somewhere and taking my sunglasses off just to see the purity. And then I'll some photographers too. There's amazing photographers out there from past to present that have like so inspiring still photography that I follow or buy their books, because I like to have like, you know, encourage artists and buy books when they publish photography books. You know, painters. I have a lot of art books, you know, from, you know, like the ancient painting to most recent modern and all that. And yeah, films that inspired me in the past that I can reference, you know, for just sometimes a scene or just different aspect, you know, and it can be multiple film for just one film that I'm working on. I'm referencing multiple. So all of that combined gives you so much ammunition for inspiration.
And really, before I let you go, what is a recent either show, commercial, film that you've seen that really you felt was fantastic from a color perspective?
Apart from mine, I'm just kidding. That was funny. I thought what they did with Wonka was fun. I liked it. I thought it was like beautiful, inviting, and the color palette was very suiting. The skin tone, because it's not easy to be in that color palette, and all the skin tones felt really nice. It was not overly rosy or overly dark or whatever. So I like the look of that. I also thought it was very interesting narratively, the movie with the actress that won the Oscar, you know, the Frankenstein.
Poor Things.
I thought it was interesting that narratively what they did with the black and white and the color and, you know, all of that, like, worked really well. And without being on the nose, I just think it had like a really good arc of what it was doing. These are the ones that come like fresh in my mind right now, because, you know, they were kind of original and a little different, and I could see like some of the difficulties in what they were doing. Because sometimes you see something that is really like great achieve, you know, like executed, you know, mm-hmm. But for me, like, sometimes I can see what the colorist had to do in order to get there and the difficulty of that. And in those two, I thought, oh, I could see some, you know, challenge and all that. And I thought it was very well executed.
Maxine, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. That's very kind of you.
Thank you for listening to Post Perspectives Meet the Artist podcast, sponsored by Puget Systems. For more information, please visit PugetSystems.com.